The White House prepares for the NATO summit.
At the summit, I expect allied leaders to agree for NATO to lead the coordination and provision of security assistance and training for Ukraine.
Plus, a look at Gaza refugees.
Most people who flee are searching for someplace safe. But in Gaza, residents say there is no such place inside the enclave. So they keep moving to stay alive.
And later, the U.S. reaffirms support for Tibet, Ukraine strikes Russian oil facilities, and Vladimir Putin heads to North Korea. Today is Tuesday, June 18th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. We'll begin the show in Washington, where President Joe Biden met with NATO's chief on Monday. It's about 3 weeks before the larger-than-ever NATO summit, also in Washington. And at the White House, the two leaders spoke of how they'll ensure predictable support for Ukraine for the long haul through a plan that puts NATO in charge of coordinating security assistance and training, not the U.S., and how they'll come up with the estimated $45 billion needed each year to pay for it. Anita Powell reports from the White House.
NATO is not resting on its laurels as it turns 75. On Monday, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg landed in Washington to hash out plans for a July summit that will explore how the security grouping can support Ukraine's fight against Russia's invasion. President Joe Biden praised the alliance and said a record number of members are meeting NATO's commitment to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense.
NATO was founded 75 years ago, and it's, I think the lessons we've learned then and about standing together to defend and deter aggression have been consequential. And we've made NATO, under your leadership, we made it larger, stronger, and then it's more united than it's ever been.
Earlier Monday, Stoltenberg said NATO allies had given unprecedented support to Ukraine. He estimates this will cost the alliance at least $45 billion per year going forward.
At the summit, I expect allied leaders to agree for NATO to lead the coordination and provision of security assistance and training for Ukraine. It is also why I have proposed a long-term financial pledge with fresh funding every year. The more credible our long-term support, the quicker Moscow will realize it cannot wait us out, and the sooner this war can end. It may seem like a paradox, but the path to peace is therefore more weapons for Ukraine.
Analysts say these discussions are setting the agenda for the upcoming summit. Dan Hamilton is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The main issues still are... What does the alliance say to Ukraine after our pledges of support over the last few weeks? What is the nature of the NATO-Ukraine relationship going forward? NATO is taking over from the United States the military assistance and coordination of military training for Ukraine. That's a major step that's happening right now.
Last week, Ukraine's president praised a 10-year security agreement with the U.S., saying it lays a path for the one thing Ukraine wants most, to belong to NATO. Volodymyr Zelensky is president of Ukraine.
The issue of NATO is covered through the text of the agreement. It states that America supports Ukraine's future membership in NATO and recognizes that our security agreement is a bridge to Ukraine's membership in NATO.
That bridge may be long, Hamilton said, noting that other nations are also making bilateral commitments to Ukraine in the meantime. Dan Hamilton.
Some of them pledging, basically mutual defense, others pledging military support over a longer period of time. So again, the Ukrainians can count on that support.
How the war could end is also on NATO's radar, Hamilton said, as is the growing awareness that there are threats beyond the North Atlantic, as reflected in the plans by the leaders of Japan, Australia, South Korea and New Zealand to attend the summit, which starts in Washington on July 9th. Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
Turning our attention to Israel and the war in Gaza, The United Nations says the percentage of people in the world who fled their homes to protect their lives has doubled in the past decade. But in Gaza, families say no matter how many times they run, they cannot find safety. VOA's Heather Murdoch has the story.
Amani El-Shefi and her three children have been forced to flee the war six times since last October. The first place they fled was their home in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, which, she has been told, is now a pile of rubble. El-Shefi says they fled because they were terrified by non-stop bombing. They had no messages from the government and no warning. Since then, she has moved south multiple times as the war between Israel and Hamas followed. When she reached the southern border city of Rafah, she set up camp with most of the Gaza Strip's 2 million-plus population, as famine in the north began also to creep south. Almost all the hospitals were closed and the water supplies were dwindled before the assault on Rafah began last month. El-Shefi then traveled back north to this vast campsite in Khan Yunis. Here, there is no electricity, cooking gas, running water, and very little food, she says. She says she cannot find basic food items like vegetables, oil, meat, and milk for her children. The United Nations says roughly 120 million people are now forcibly displaced worldwide, living outside their homes, forced to flee wars, persecution, and other human rights violations. Most people who flee are searching for someplace safe, but in Gaza, residents say there is no such place inside the enclave, so they keep moving to stay alive. Rafa Musa Farhat is a retired schoolteacher in Gaza. He laments that women, children, and the elderly are being killed, sometimes in their own homes, by bombs. Few families have escaped Gaza, but the vast majority remain because the borders are closed, and escape requires far more money than most displaced people have left. And many people, like Farhat, say they wouldn't leave, even if they could, lest they lose their homeland forever. Gaza's Ministry of Health says more than 37,000 people in Gaza have been killed and more than 85,000 injured since the war began in October, after Hamas killed 1,200 people in Israel and took more than 250 hostages in a surprise attack. As summer heat sets in and the battles continue, more civilians are expected to die from sickness due to lack of food, health care, clean water, and sanitation. Even if the war ends tomorrow, says El-Shefi, Gaza is already in ruins. She says Gaza will be frightening and terrible in terms of lack of electricity and water, and the destruction of land, streets, and homes. Multiple attempts at peace negotiations have failed in recent months, with Israel vowing the war will end only in their total victory, including the return of all hostages and the dismantling of Hamas. For Nadal Hamduna, Amjad Tantesh, and Enas Tantesh in Khan Yunis, Gaza, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
Kyiv on Tuesday accused Russian forces of beheading a Ukrainian serviceman in the eastern Donetsk region. It's the latest allegation of abuse levied by Ukrainian prosecutors against Moscow. Both Ukraine and Russia have accused each other's militaries of battlefield misconduct tantamount to war crimes, and Kyiv has called for a special tribunal to investigate abuses as part of the conditions to end the war. All this as Russian forces continue the shelling of Ukrainian infrastructure, while Ukrainian forces target Russian oil refineries with drones. Meanwhile, a new Russian land offensive is expected in the Kharkiv region. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
On June 17, Russian troops launched missile, artillery, and drone attacks on the Poltava, Dnipropetrovsk, Kherson, and Kharkiv regions. As a result of the attacks, civil and critical infrastructure was damaged in the Poltava region. 12 people were injured, including 2 children. According to preliminary information, power lines were affected, causing electricity cut off for 53,000 residents and 2,400 businesses. The Kherson and Kharkiv regions also remain under heavy Russian shelling. According to the local authorities, about 50,000 residents are experiencing electricity blackouts in the Kharkiv region at this time. Meanwhile, new escalation is expected in the Kharkiv region, as analysts of the Ukrainian Deep State Channel report that Russian forces have increased the number of their servicemen to 10,000 personnel and 450 units of military equipment in the area near Borovaya in the Kharkiv region. According to them, the Russian goal is a new offensive on Borovaya. Ukrainian forces are getting ready for the defense. However, their capacities are inferior to the Russian ones in number. Meanwhile, numerous explosions were heard in the Rostov region of Russia on Tuesday morning. Local residents reported the sounds of explosions throughout the night near the railway station and the port, where oil depot and fuel terminals are located. According to the local authorities, as a result of the drone attack, oil refineries with a total of 5,000 cubic meters of oil were hit. Ukrainian media, quoting sources in the Ukrainian special services, report that Ukrainian drones were used for the attack. The Rostov oil depot, which has a total of 22 fuel tanks, were targeted. According to preliminary information, Ukrainian drones have already carried out more than 20 successful attacks on the Russian oil complex in various regions. While the Russia-Ukraine war continues, Ukrainian authorities increase the army recruitment options, introducing more digital solutions to military services. Katerina Chernohorenko, Deputy Minister of Defense for Digitalization, reported that from June 18, the electronic military registration document, which every conscript can generate in his online account in the Reserve Plus application, will become equivalent to a physical paper document. Now, Ukrainian conscripts are not obliged to carry a paper military ID at all times. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is in North Korea for a state visit with Kim Jong-un. It's aimed at strengthening the military and economic ties between their two countries, as they both face increasing pressure from the West. Gabe Singer of Reuters has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has promised North Korea trade and security not controlled by the West. It came in a letter published Tuesday by North Korean state media, where Putin pledged his unwavering support of the isolated state. That was a day after the two countries announced that Putin would visit North Korea for the first time in 24 years, for a two-day trip beginning Tuesday. Putin's letter said, quote, "We will develop alternative mechanisms of trade and mutual settlements that are not controlled by the West, and jointly resist illegitimate unilateral restrictions. And at the same time," he added, "we will build an architecture of equal and indivisible security in Eurasia." He also thanked North Korea for supporting what Russia calls its special military operation in Ukraine, and vowed support for Pyongyang's efforts to defend its interests, despite what he called, quote, U.S. pressure, blackmail, and military threats. There have been some signs pointing to what's on the agenda for Putin when he visits. Commercial satellite imagery taken ahead of the visit showed preparations for a possible military parade in downtown Pyongyang. Russian media said there will be one-on-one discussions between Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and Putin's foreign policy advisor said Russia and North Korea may sign a partnership agreement during the visit that would include security issues. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller repeated charges this week that North Korea had supplied weapons to Russia for use in Ukraine. Moscow and Pyongyang have denied arms transfers. After North Korea, Putin is set to spend another 2 days in Vietnam.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Asia, the Philippines said on Tuesday one of its Navy personnel was severely injured after the China Coast Guard intentionally rammed a Philippine vessel in the South China Sea on Monday. Philippine officials say China disrupted a military mission to resupply sailors stationed in the Second Thomas Shoal in a rusting Navy ship that Manila deliberately beached there in 1999 to bolster its maritime claim. China's Coast Guard disputed this and said the Navy vessel deliberately and dangerously approached a Chinese ship, forcing it to take measures. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Azerbaijan, Turkey, Israel, and oil. That story coming up. Now, back to Washington, where President Joe Biden will sign the bipartisan bill passed by Congress last week that reaffirms Tibetan rights. This just ahead of the Dalai Lama's trip to the U.S. for medical care.
And we are very excited to see His Holiness tomorrow to talk about many things, including the bill we just passed out of Congress that basically says that the United States of America stands with the people of Tibet.
So will the President Biden sign this bill?
Yes, he will.
That's Republican Representative Michael McCaul on Tuesday as he led a bipartisan congressional delegation to India. The delegation of American lawmakers, including Democratic former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, planned to meet the Dalai Lama during their visit to Dharamsala, the town in the northern Indian Himalayas where the Tibetan spiritual leader lives in exile. So what's in the bill that President Biden will sign? For more on that, I'm joined by Tenzin Tetong, head of VOA's Tibetan service.
This bill is called the Resolve Tibet Act. And one of the things it does is that it defines Tibet in a wholesome manner. As of now, the Chinese government, when they refer to Tibet, they mean an area called the Tibet Autonomous Region, which is slightly larger than half of the Tibetan Plateau, whereas large parts of northeastern and eastern Tibet are included into adjoining Chinese provinces. So the Tibet defined by China is very limited, and the U.S. law defines Tibet as all these Tibetan areas on the Tibetan Plateau.
So that's a big change for the U.S. government, then.
So it's a big change, and this act also tries to address the Tibet issue by saying Tibet's status has not been properly defined according to international law.
Now, it seems that the U.S. and China have many sources of tension these days. Economically, security in the South China Sea, the Taiwan issue. Is adding more fuel to the fire by antagonizing China over the Tibet issue helpful in the long run? How does the Tibetan community see this?
Yes, in one way one could say it appears like it's adding more fuel to the fire, but this is not a issue where the U.S. has not spoken already. In fact, more than 10 years ago, Congress passed a bill called the Tibet Policy Act, in which they already defined Tibet with all these adjoining Tibetan areas in Chinese provinces. And they've also called for Chinese government to respect the will of the Tibetan people and encouraging dialogue as well. So in a way, this is almost like a rehash of some key items that have already been adopted by U.S. Congress. And at some level, even the State Department has moved forward by establishing a special coordinator position for Tibet, and they play a role in trying to implement some of these congressional resolutions.
One of the things consuming attention all over the world is the struggle, the war in Israel and Gaza, and the struggle for Palestinian independence, and people arguing for a Palestinian state, for Palestinian independence. Is there any sense among the Tibetan community that it's your turn, that there should be the same kind of vocal opposition to China that we see against Israel?
That's true. The Tibetans feel that they have been largely ignored by the world, and the Tibetans have felt that we have been sacrificed to a large extent on many levels simply to please the Chinese. But the cause of the Tibetan people are genuine. It really is about human freedom. It really is about preserving culture and language, which has deep meaning for ourselves, as well as in some ways relevance to the changing world. There's meaning in culture and spirituality, and we are trying to say, you know, Tibet should be preserved not just for the Tibetans, but, you know, as part of global diversity in some ways.
Tenzin Tetong is the chief of VOA's Tibetan service. Tenzin, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Protests in Turkey are growing over Azerbaijani oil deliveries to Israel. Azerbaijani oil exports have continued to pass through a Turkish port, despite Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's recent announcement of a trade embargo against Israel because of the offensive in Gaza. Dorian Jones has the story from Istanbul.
Protesters have been targeting Azerbaijan's supply of oil to Israel through the Turkish port of Ceyhan. Azerbaijan, a close ally of Israel, meets about 40% of Israeli oil needs, a trade that appears unaffected by Israel's war on Hamas. Galia Lindenstrauss is an analyst with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
Trade between Israel and Azerbaijan is continuing as normal. I would even say that since Azerbaijan opened an embassy just a year ago in Israel, the trade relations have actually expanded. But again, most of the trade is surrounds the oil flowing from Azerbaijan to Israel through Turkey and the weapons acquisition Azerbaijan does in Israel.
Protests of Turkish-Israeli trade have damaged President Recep Tayyip Erdogan politically. His AK party suffered substantial losses in local elections in March. And analysts say trade with Israel, along with Turkey's economic crisis, were major reasons why voters turned against him. Sezin Öner is a commentator on Turkey's Politikyol news portal.
Had there not been the economic crisis, probably they wouldn't be also so concerned about the trade with Israel. But the economic crisis somehow removed the rosy glasses, rose-colored glasses of many people in Turkey, including the AK Party supporters. So they started to see things as they are, and they started to criticize the government.
Following his local election defeat, Erdogan imposed an Israeli trade embargo, boasting that Turkey was at the forefront of confronting Israel. But Erdogan has close ties with Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, and Azerbaijan's state energy company, Soka, is the biggest international investor in Turkey. Therefore, analysts say stopping Azerbaijani oil exports to Israel is difficult for the Turkish leader. There are other factors for Turkey to consider. Mehmet Ergüçü is an analyst at the London Energy Club, a grouping of government and energy sector leaders.
Azeri-Israeli relationship has been consolidated. It is a bulwark against Iran as well, in some regards. And therefore, Azeris, although I'm sure they are also unhappy with what's happening in Gaza as a result of the Israeli land forces attack, and they would probably impress on Erdogan not to go that far.
With protests in Turkey against Azerbaijani oil exports to Israel continuing, police are stepping up arrests against organizers, prompting more protests, which analysts say further undermine Erdogan's claim of being at the forefront of confronting Israel, Sezin Öner of Politikyol news portal.
Government said that they stopped the trade with Israel, but somehow it's continuing in other ways. So I think the real culprit, more so than the Azerbaijan companies or the Azerbaijan Aliyev or other circles in Azerbaijan itself, it will be the government who's going to be held responsible for those protesting and for the conservative basis specifically.
With many protesters drawn from Erdogan's traditionally religious conservative base, analysts warn the political cost for the Turkish leader over the ongoing oil trade with Israel is likely to grow. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.